Hello, and welcome to a Seen and Unseen Aloud special. It's great to have you with us. From time to time, we have Seen and Unseen Aloud specials, either a box set of episodes on a particular theme, or a special episode such as an interview. As ever, we're here for you when you need to be eyes-free or hands-free, but still want to hear Christian perspectives on just about everything.
Hello and welcome to this special edition of Seen and Unseen Aloud. I'm Graham Tomlin, the director of the Centre for Cultural Witness. And a few weeks ago, we were thinking about how we would cover the American election in this really important year for politics, both on this side of the Atlantic in the UK and on the other side on the USA as well. And I decided that I'd have a conversation with an old friend, Miroslav Volf, who is he's a professor of theology. He's the Henry B. Wright Professor of Theology at University of Yale in the USA. He's also the director of the Yale Center for Faith and Culture there. He comes from Croatia, has written some very influential books of theology over the years, and is a really deep thinker about aspects of faith and culture and politics and so many other things. And I thought he would be a great person to give us a bit of a guide as to how things are in the USA at the moment, give his reflections on American politics, what's happening in the USA at the moment with the election coming up, on Christian nationalism and all the themes that are related to it. So I called him up. We had a conversation on Zoom, and what you're about to hear is that conversation playing itself out. So I hope you really enjoy this listening, and that you find it a really enlightening way to think about our political life together and how Christian faith helps us to understand that and give new perspectives on our life together. So I'm joined today by Miroslav Volf from Center for Faith and Culture in Yale Divinity School and Yale University. So Miroslav, great to see you today.
It's always wonderful to see you and to talk to you.
Very good. And we're going to talk a little bit about life in the US at the moment in an election year and some of the issues around that, and to get some of your reflections on that as well. I mean, I suppose just to start off with, I don't know what your reflections are on the mood in the USA at the moment as the election kind of approaches later in the year. We have an election here in the UK. We've got a kind of gathering sense of that coming. But how would you describe the mood in the US at the moment?
It's really tough to describe it, but I think I would say that predominantly it's kind of belligerent, and in some circles belligerent with hope, and another circle belligerent with apprehensiveness, with uncertainty. I think American, roughly speaking, left isn't happiest with its candidate, whether Joe Biden can actually perform against Trump. And on the other side, I see certain kind of triumphalism and increasing radicalism that's for many people worrisome. So. Worry, willingness to fight, and inability to discern how to fight, things of that sort, I see. And some of my colleagues determined to leave the country if things don't turn quite the way that they have imagined. And I tell them, you know, I'm used to living under authoritarian regimes. You know, that's how I grew up, and it's possible.
Exactly, that's right. And I was wondering about, because of course back in, I think it's 1996, you published Exclusion and Embrace, which I guess largely came out of your experience in Croatia and sort of living, as you say, under a totalitarian regime. And really, which was looking at, I think, I was struck by that phrase you used in it, what kind of selves do we need to be to live in harmony with others? I wonder how you reflect on writing that book now in the context of America at the moment, which seems much more polarized than it was back in 1996. Is there some of that work that seems to resonate particularly with the US situation right now?
I think so. And my sense was maybe five, six, 7 years ago it started. I'm not sure exactly where to draw this line or when I perceived it. I sensed that the fronts were hardening and they have mutually become unporous, and that any defection is seen toward the middle, toward reconcile. Any reconciling move has been seen as a defection, and weakening of each of the sides. And I can clearly see that in, and I have experienced that, feel it actually, in former Yugoslavia, where when I wrote the book, it fell on deaf ears of both Croats and Serbs and Muslims. And I think it was published at the time where they were having a fight and they wanted to kind of continue the momentum of that fight. And so my sense was reconcilers, in a sense, are needed at the time when fronts are a bit more porous than in situations that I've just described, which is to say that the time for reconcilers is your ordinary time that prepares for the situations of this sort, rather than certain kinds of interventions in the actual conflict situation. And as to the kinds of selves, I think it's a kind of selves that resist being closed by the boundaries that of the combatants in the fight. Those who are able to see beyond, to see the unseen, to hope for the unhoped for, and to have a certain kind of sovereign distance from each of the sides and the moral ground on which they stand and pursue their calling.
And I guess in that book you also wrote about, I think, about repentance and forgiveness as being crucial elements in reconciliation. And you talk about reconcilers there and the role of reconciliation. Do you see much evidence of repentance and forgiveness within the current situation? If not, what would it take to bring about that kind of culture within American life?
Yeah. I don't see much willingness. I see the culture on both sides, in a sense, being unforgiving. And I often think about and reflect and try to parse out why that type of unwillingness to forgive. There are, of course, ritualistic gestures of forgiveness. They abound in different domains of life, but they're kind of public image management tools rather than actual sense of moral self-examination, standing by what one has done. I think we need to, again, this is one of those things that we need to nurture. I find it difficult. This is how I think about it, especially in the modern cultures, which is different than former Yugoslavia, but kind of cultures of late modernity. We have this narratival construal of the self. I am what I have done, what has been done to me, what I have made out of what I've done and what others have done to me, kind of notion of the self. But if you have this kind of notion of the self, how do you do what I think the miracle of forgiveness does? How do you unglue the past deed from the self that has committed that deed, when that deed is by definition definitive of the person? And so I think we see how forgiveness is rooted in a kind of vision of who the self is and how the self stands in the world and before God. So I think again that emphasizes importance of the Christian message and deep theological reflection on it.
Yeah, no, that's really helpful, that understanding of the self. And I guess one of the thoughts I've had recently is that a lot of our kind of identity politics language tries to isolate one particular aspect of a person's self. And so say, that's the only thing I need to know about you. So I might say to you, you know, you're Miroslav, you're Croatian. That's the only thing that really matters about you. Therefore, I know what you're like, you're Croatian. And therefore, I can either say, well, you're one of my tribe or you're not one of my tribe. And I can either dismiss you or accept you that way. But of course, you know, we are as people much more complex than that. We're much more multifaceted. We have different identities that are not just about nationality, but they're about relationship and embeddedness within society and political allegiance and origins and, you know, all kinds of sort of different facets of our society. And that trend within the kind of understanding of the self is really quite unhelpful in enabling us to engage with each other as persons, as opposed to just a kind of, you know, figment of our imagination.
It's kind of betrayal of the particularity of the self and inability to actually perceive the person as a particular individual. I think that's also the case in kind of ethnic conflicts or political conflicts as well. I remember I was saying when during the war in former Yugoslavia, sure, we are Croatians and we're Serbian, but part of the definition of being a Croatian is to have Serbian as your neighbor. Okay. Historically, yeah. So you've been we've been shaped historically over the centuries, and you can't just erase this out of the identity. But obviously, in the situation of conflict, the last thing you want to hear that you have been defined by your relationship to the person who you want to now obliterate.
Yeah, exactly. And you can see that same dynamic playing out in the sort of Israel-Gaza situation right now, that in many ways Israel is defined by its relationship with the Palestinians. Palestinians are defined by the relationship with Israelis, and you can't get away from that. It's like a Cain and Abel all over again, you know, that sort of encounter. You're kind of defined by the other in so many ways.
Yeah, exactly.
And I guess in a time of, we hear about culture wars. You know, there was that sort of thesis of the clash of civilizations that came from Samuel Huntington some many years ago. You know, we think about, you know, progressives and conservatives offering different visions of the future. And I guess in the United States, that's a very sort of polarized, toxic debate. Do you think that Christian faith offers a different path from either? Does it beckon us on a third path that is different from the conservative and the progressive polarity?
Yeah, especially with hardened polarities of the sort, and as we all also said, polarities that are concentrated on particular, almost symbolic issues, important issues politically, but they function more than just with regard to their actual importance. They function also symbolically to kind of distinguish the two groups and to stabilize their identity. I think particularly in those kinds of situations, you know, the old adage, I don't care what's left and what's right. I care for what's right and what's wrong. And in some ways, this right and wrong contrast, we sometimes deem it as this dualistic moralism of religious traditions. And obviously, it can be lived in those ways. But if we understand it in the properly Christian way, this contrast between right and wrong seems to me really important, because it provides us a place on which to stand and which to engage and assess both sides that are in this rather sterile, caught in this rather sterile conflict. And it seems to me that nurturing this Christian independence and returning back to the big question that Bonhoeffer asked toward the end of his stay in toward the end of his imprisonment, who is Jesus Christ for us today? That seemed to me to be really a central question, and this temptation of the churches, and you see it in United States on both sides, left and right, kind of certain kind of identification of the churches with the politics of the thing, and not sufficient distance. I don't know if you've seen this book, Kingdom, the Power and the Glory.
No,
Tim Alberta. which is very, very, very interesting analysis. He's a staff writer in Atlantic, and has written, this is his second book now on American Carnage was first, and then this is the second book, looking primarily at evangelicalism and the churches and the kind of betrayal of the gospel, the thinning out of evangelicalism to certain issues and certain stances in politics, almost like a nationalist civil religion. It functions. Content is really unimportant. The kind of functioning as a sacred canopy in defense of certain vision of America is what it's all about.
Yeah, because I guess one of the questions I often hear here in the UK is people wondering how the evangelical church in the USA is so seemingly solidly behind Donald Trump, who shows no particular sign of a Christian faith, let alone evangelical faith. And how do you explain that? Clearly there's an element that he will endorse certain conservative positions, which kind of in favor of that evangelicals are in favor of. Is there something deeper going on than that? How do you read that movement of the evangelical church to kind of support Donald Trump?
Well, for a long time, I thought, and that's not true only of evangelicalism in this country, but in other settings of various Christian religious kind of traditions, is that nation ends up being much more powerful goddess than the father of our Lord Jesus Christ, so that. Almost when there's a sense of threat, everybody coalesces around defense of that particular group identity. You know, my colleague here, sociologist Phil Gorski, has written this interesting article, "The Return of the King," and he talks about the shift from disenchantment and secularization to re-enchantment toward new immanentism, and then in the context of that, so it's kind of repaganization in some ways of the culture, broadly of the culture. And in the context of that, he talks about this return of the king, and not king as a kind of sacred kingship, which was then responsible for had certain kind of moral frame in which was placed in obligation to the divine, to God, but as a divine king, in a sense, who functions simply as kind of standing for this particular community, responsible to no one, sheer exercise of power. And then he invokes this vision of a stranger king. King that comes from nowhere, from outside, and who's bound to know mores, a particular more existing mores, but who is seen as this rescuer that's going to rescue us. And I think that speaks to way in which people understand Trump. It doesn't matter how he behaves. He can be, as he said, you know, he can kill somebody in the middle of New York, and that won't have impact on how people view him. We know his sexual escapades, and that doesn't have any impact on how people view him. Now the suits also are there, and again, so there is this kind of, and I think of it that people think both on the right and the left that we are I would put far right and far left, that we are a kind of revolutionary situation. So Bannon is a very, very good example. He wants Leninist politics, which is to say taking on state apparatus and dismantling everything that was going on. So there's a certain radicalism that is then needs to be obsessed with power. And I think that's where Trump has come in. And he has found also religious interpreters that help him emerge as a new Cyrus or somebody who need not be held to moral standards, because that's what's perceived to be needed right now.
Yeah, that's it. That idea of re-paganization is a really interesting one, I think. And that idea of Trump as almost being a kind of, almost like a kind of Roman emperor figure, for whom morality didn't really apply that much.
We
had something of it similar a little bit here, not quite as extreme, but, you know, when Boris Johnson was prime minister here, a number of figures have suggested that in his great heroes, I mean, he's the one prime minister in recent times who has not really professed any very obvious Christian faith. He sort of has a, you know, he got married in a Roman Catholic church because it suited him, I guess. But but you know, his great heroes are the kind of the classics of Roman Greece, and many people said he's almost more pagan than Christian. There wasn't a great vision of political kind of harmony or vision there. It was much about power and about the assertion of power and so on. And there's something going on there about paganism's interest in just sort of naked power. There's kind of Nietzschean element of it as well.
And there is, if I read things correctly, at least a few years back, some of the neo-pagan philosophers, partly building on Nietzsche, there's a kind of little sliver of Heidegger coming through. Nietzsche is coming to De Benoit, kind of retrieval of paganism, and he's got they have been speakers at some of the far right conferences, and you can understand why.
Sure. And I guess one of the themes that you mentioned a moment ago was that of the nation, and I guess one of the things that you notice from this side of the pond, looking at America, is that very strong kind of nationalism, kind of Christian nationalism. You go into American churches and there's a flag at the front, and you know, the idea of this is a kind of Christian nation, which I guess goes back to the, you know, some of the kind of Puritan vision that founded America. How do you read that, again, theologically? And is the nation, do you see the nation as a positive thing theologically, or a negative thing? Is it something we should be suspicious of? Is it something that should be embraced? How do you view that, and how do you view that kind of sense of Christian nationalism in the USA that you often notice there?
Yeah, I suppose that I'm disappointed in the strength of that nationalism. I mean, I think sometimes it's useful to differentiate between patriotism and nationalism, though this is somewhat arbitrary linguistic distinction that's being made. But certainly, it's as I see it, it's important to distinguish between a commitment to one's particular group, nation being one example, that is kind of exclusivist, or that is kind of set in the larger context of universalism. I kind of think that Christians are universalist by the very nature of our Christian faith, and that to me is rooted in a, you know, simple conviction that each one of us is created in the image of God, and for each one of us, Christ died on the cross and was raised to our justification. And it seems to me that I cannot place relative values on people given proximity to me. What I can have is greater responsibility to those with whom my life is more closely intertwined, as we pray in Episcopal and Anglican liturgy. So I'm worried about this. I'm worried, frankly, also about American universalism, because it was projecting American interests in ways that I find problematic. Now, if that nationalism is closing in on itself, it's a kind of version of the same thing, right? One was aggressive, the other one was withdrawing, but it's all interested in oneself, and it's one's own well-being. I think we need to have an order in which we can world order in which we can affirm the dignity of all human beings and express care for especially those upon whom we have had such negative impacts and whose life has been curtailed because we in the West have exerted our power in ways that are deeply problematic.
Well, I guess the other aspect of that is that the church is a sort of multinational community.
Yep. Yep.
In the sense that, I mean, as we put it, that in the Christian church, you know, water is thicker than blood. In other words, that the water, the baptism that binds us is stronger than sort of ethnic difference that divides us. And that actually the church is a community that reaches across every nation of the world. Those bonds are stronger than any other bonds, and therefore that relativizes the nation as an entity that defines us. Doesn't mean we can't be, you know, having a certain patriotic pride in our nation and our origins, the particularity of that, which is a good thing. We're all rooted in places and histories, which is a part of who we are. But that identity of being Christian and bound to each other relativizes that sense of the nation as being what ultimately defines us as a people.
Yeah, and I think that would be one example in this situation today that I don't care what's left, what's right in this regard. I care about those substantive commitments that we have, and I think that are deeply not just resonant, or that not just stem out of the Christian faith, but that they in a way are healing for the planet as a whole.
Yeah, and you think what would it be if people across the culture wars would actually recognize each other's Christian faith as being a stronger bond than the ideological differences that divide people? Then what would that look like?
Or in situations of conflict, if we would realize a value of a person of my ethnic group and of another ethnic group is exactly the same.
Yep.
So that would have profound implication in terms of how we even when we engage in violent in what we might deem as a justified a just war, how that conduct of war is done would be greatly changed if we thought of one side and the other, each individual absolutely equal value.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely right. One of the other themes I want to explore a little bit was I guess one of the casualties of our modern political life is truth. We know we talk about a post-truth age. We are in a world where there's a massive volume of opinion and idea and data that comes at us every day because of the nature of the information revolution we've been through with the internet and social media. And I guess the question is, why does truth matter in politics? I recall, I think something you wrote in Exclusion and Embrace, that somebody said something like, "If argument cannot win, weapons must." There's something about once truth goes, it kind of leads to violence. So, what do you just expand on that a little bit and explore that theme?
Yeah, and I think I've also I think that's a line from Exclusion and Embrace. I mean, thinking tends to be to go this way. If truth is against me, why should I be for the truth?
Yeah.
Right? And so so it's a very easy casualty to my own interest. And we can observe that from a little kid saying some kind of innocent lie, quote-unquote innocent lie, to all the way to the political situations, world politics, where, I mean, it's a kind of a lie is the homage to the truth, because lie presents itself as truth. And I think that homage needs to be paid, because there cannot be reliable trust between people unless truth is being spoken, and without trust, the society simply collapse. And I think good deal of the tensions are rooted in this country, are rooted in inability to trust that what the other person says it is correct, so that there's a constant tooth of suspicion that nibbles on any form of relationship that we have. And in that sense, I think what Jesus said about truth, that it will set us free, that it sets us free. It binds us, but precisely by binding us to one another in truthfulness, it sets us free, each one of us.
Yeah, that begins to open up. The last area I wanted to explore with you, which was, you're on a course in Yale called Life Worth Living, which is something that you do for students who want to explore some of those deeper questions as to what a life worth living is. And I'd love you to just explain a bit about how that course works, but particularly thinking of the theme we're talking about today. What is a life worth living in this particular moment in the USA? You talked at the beginning about, you know, you've lived under totalitarian regimes. It's possible to live a life, even a good life, in really difficult circumstances. What does that life look like at the moment? So maybe a little bit about the course, but also about how that plays out in America in a year leading towards an election, a life that's worth living.
You know, in some ways, I think of that course as a kind of exercise in truth speaking about what matters most to us in life, in community with those who disagree with us, because courses offered to Yale students, Yale College students, undergrads primarily. And generally, we have a group of students who come from very different backgrounds. They form a seminar group. There are about six or seven seminar groups each semester. And we have these competing visions of the good life that we discuss in sequence. And we each name who we are and what our allegiances are at the very beginning. And then when I teach the class, I tell the students, you know, these traditions, whether that's Buddhism or Confucianism or Christianity or Islam, they make certain truth claims. And that making truth claims means that they're not talking about just aesthetic or other kinds of preferences with regard to the visions of life. They're making truth claims. And if they're making truth claims, they're talking about your life. And so I want you to take them at their word and wrestle with them as truth claims and wrestle together with your fellow students. And I think that is a very important to me exercise in how one can, in a pluralistic setting, affirm and stay by the truth while at the same time entertaining seriously opinions of others, even sometimes adjusting one's own perspectives from perspective of others. And I think something of that sort we need, and not just at the level of hyper goods, which is what we discuss in some ways, right? Goods that follow from those hyper goods that organize our entire life, but that they express themselves also in profound disagreements on political, cultural, economic issues. And I'm hoping that we can, one, think of these issues as matters of truth and take them seriously, but at the same time, recognize also that truth can be discussed in a civil kind of way without claiming that because one thinks that one is espousing truth, that this is the final word that must be said, without absolutizing the positions that we have. And I think some such discourse we need in the politics of today.
Yeah, so a life worth living would be a life where you can have those kind of conversations.
Certainly at the political level, yes, where we can and then where we can shape our future, yeah, in common with having these types of conversations.
And do you see any signs of hope at the moment within the kind of this discourse within the USA? I mean, you started off by talking about how there's a sense of anxiety and maybe belligerence within it. Are there signs that give you just a little glimmer of hope that there may be a different future going forward?
Well, it seems to me, when I speak about this class to people, I don't experience yawns of people, nor do I think, oh, starry-eyed, thinking about something that cannot happen. I see people listening and wanting to move in that direction. When I talk about the in churches about who is Jesus Christ for us today, I don't find resistance. I find people saying, "Oh, yeah, that's what we need to take seriously, because we are in a moment, in a kind of dystopian moment, and if we don't have a source from which to speak and which to imagine afresh a life, it's going to be worse for us." And I think sometimes I also want to say it's not just a matter of the political situation in which we are. That's what's immediately before our eyes. But we have a tremendous world-changing processes at work, which I think partly underpin those political tensions. And I think we need to cast our eye to that which is underneath political tensions. What happens with AI? What's happening with our environment? What's happening with the global disparities in wealth? Things that profoundly will shape our future. And we need to nurture Christian imagination, imagining a kind of a world that we have glimpses of it opened up in the biblical traditions. And if we can think it for today, I find when I speak about those things, people are listening, which is to say there is a place in them that resonates and wants hope and sees in the Christian faith also maybe on one way of expressing that hope, but nonetheless, one that they're at least willing to listen to.
Yeah, no, that's really good to hear that. So that both the course that you run itself is a sign of hope, but some of those resonances that it's finding both in the church and wider society as well. Miroslav, thank you so much for taking time to talk today. It's been fascinating just to get your take on life in the US right now and this really quite pivotal year and see how it works out, but also to get some of those deeper issues that you were talking about, not just the kind of surface level, yeah, the kind of the debate that goes on in public, but some of the underlying issues that are longer term trajectory. Because I guess one of the things that Christian faith does is it does think long term. It doesn't think in electoral cycles. It thinks in centuries, not decades or years. And so getting that bigger perspective is really helpful today. So thank you so much. And thank you for your time today.
Thank you. Thank you for the conversation. It's always great to talk to you. I imagine our sitting around the coffee table or tea table in your sense and talking about things.
Thank you for listening. If you like our podcast, help others to discover it. Leave a review and rate us wherever you get Seen and Unseen Aloud. Help others discover a world that is greater, more full of meaning and sense than they might ever have imagined.